Welcome to Attention Confidential, the podcast where we explore deep self-awareness, bold curiosity, and passionate advocacy for both ourselves and our communities. I am your host, Maggie Green, and I'm here to remind you, your voice matters and your stories are safe here.
In support of safety, please be advised that this podcast contains explicit language and direct or indirect references to material which some listeners may find triggering. Topics are highly personal and intimate, likely to touch on themes including but not limited to abuse, bigotry, body image, disability, mental health, sexuality, and trauma. Please prioritize your safety and the safety of those around you who may be exposed to this material, especially young folks. Please also note, this is an ongoing project, which means I am actively engaged in learning while creating. The format, the tools, and skills to produce this material are all new to me, even though I've been nurturing the idea for Attention Confidential for almost 3 years. As I build and refine, I ask that you understand there may be kinks along the way. And because transparency is one of my core values, I should also share that I am using software that includes enhanced features to simplify the editing and post-production process. Any editing of this content, however, this original, organic, human-generated content, is done so at my discretion, specifically to optimize sound quality, not to manipulate, omit, or alter any substantive material in the recordings.
The original music, as featured on Attention Confidential, was written, composed, and produced by Christopher Colley Biondi, a deaf pianist, composer, and dear friend in Central Kentucky, who generously provided his skills and talent to support the launch of this podcast. Welcome to another episode of Attention Confidential, where we explore self-reflection, curiosity, and advocacy in a safe container. As you all know by this point, we express these three themes as mirror, magnifying glass, and megaphone. Another special thing about this show is that some guests choose to remain anonymous. Today's guest, however, has chosen to disclose their identity. Very, very excited to welcome Eris today. They use they, them pronouns. They identify as queer and neurodivergent. We've known each other for a while, and I know a lot about them, but I'd really rather pass the mic and have them introduce themselves and tell us about who they are and what is important to them. Eris?
Hey, Maggie. Yeah, my name is Eris. I am a non-binary autistic ADHD Canadian disruptor. Those are sort of my big, those are my big kind of identity labels, I guess.
Excellent. Well, thank you for sharing that, and thank you for making the time and the space to have this conversation with me today. As you all are aware, just some kind of background and context, I am traveling. The Tragic Optimist Tour is underway and active, so we are actually in a shared physical space for the very first time. Eris has welcomed me into their home. We're sitting in this awesome podcast studio / closet environment, and so it feels really intimate, feels really personal. We're definitely going to get into some details here, of course, starting with the mirror, but I wanted you all to know where we are. Middle of the Midwest, we'll say. Greater Chicago area, for privacy reasons, we want to protect that. But yeah, Eris, so as we're thinking about this concept of self-awareness and self-reflection vis-a-vis the mirror, what would you say is something important or insightful that you've learned about yourself? What makes you uniquely you?
I think, because I'm autistic, I feel like folks need context.
Yes, so please. I'm going to do
a bunch of context. So I grew up in Montreal, Canada, in a family that was multicultural. So my father comes from the Caribbean. My mom is French-Canadian or Quebecois. And growing up, I always sort of felt like I couldn't quite fit. Wanted to fit in so bad, but I could not quite fit in no matter what I did. And that was a real struggle for me, the not fitting in and the somehow managing to upset people without even, or disrupt like what they were doing without even really trying. I knew what I wanted to do. I knew what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a mom. I wanted to be a partner. I wanted to have family. And this autistic human being who became an adult in the early 90s. I was going to say late 90s, but no, it is the early 90s I became an adult. And what was available to me at the time, I always knew, like, super cool, like, bodies are bodies. Feeling good in your body is feeling good in your body. So, like, why wouldn't people be open to sharing, sex or physical intimacy with whatever feels good? But I want to be a mom. I want to be a parent. I want to be a wife. Well, then, obviously, I've got to date dudes. That was, like, and it was, like, never worked. But it never worked. It, like, it would work for a while. And just that seeking piece of trying to find what I wanted to, but I didn't realize I was looking in the wrong place. And in my early 40s, I had not yet met a partner. I had owned two homes. I'd left a career. I had a burnout and spent a lot of time healing and examining and looking at myself and figuring out and trying to make myself fit. And it never, never worked. And in 2018, I started realizing that I was only listening to one kind of voice. Most of the media that I consumed was one voice. So I started, I've got to branch out. I've got to switch it up, hear what other voices are doing. And I started listening to Cameron Esposito's Queero podcast. I started finding podcasts from black culture, black hosts, black writers about black culture. I started trying to find indigenous podcasts. I tried to listen to more femme voices because most of the voices that I heard, I mean, everything was presented through a masculine lens, through a cis male lens. And that exploration, all of a sudden I started, oh, wait a second, that's me. That feels a little more like me. And then Hannah Gadsby's Nanette came out. And, like, it changed my world. It sort of opened up this possibility because so much of what Hannah said resonated so deeply. And I saw myself so much in just the way that they look at the world, the way that they saw problems, the way they, like, just, like, fuck Picasso. He was mentally ill. He was a pedophile. He was, like, terrible. Like, why do we uplift this art from this human being whose personal life was horrible? Which started me on a whole other thought process, which is its own very big tangent about, like, what we should take from artists or anybody who has a terrible, like, as a person. Right. They are not using good skills. They are not, their coping mechanisms lead them to hurt other people over and over and over again. But yet they have created something that has affected our world in such important ways. Like, they owe us that. They owe us their brilliance. They owe us our genius. Because if they're going to be that terrible, we should use them for what they have contributed. But I'm not going to deify you. But you owe us. You owe culture so much.
What a fresh perspective. Like, I've not heard it quite addressed in that way. You know, you hear the phrase, like, you know, the art is separate from the artist.
It's not.
Art is so personal. I didn't know we were going to touch on art in this way, but, you know, like, Michael Jackson comes to mind as an example.
J.K. Rowling.
You know, absolutely. We've talked about cognitive dissonance off the record earlier today. Like, I don't know. Yeah, they're interrelated, but that piece of, like, not entitlement, like, we're not entitled to it. It is a debt. It really is a debt. That is super interesting. So you realize you're not fitting in. You're starting to find people in places that resonate, feel more like you.
And they're not what I thought.
Right.
Listening to these queer voices, these queer people talk about their experiences and going, wait, that sounds like me, but I'm hetero.
Straight, right?
Yeah. And it was really Nanette that allowed me to sort of go, oh, I'm not. I'm not. And what does that mean? So that realization happened in about 2018. I got to see Nanette's very last show of Nanette, because it was at the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal. The audience was like so gay. I was just like, I was like a 6-month-old baby gay. Like, it was
totally.
And being in this audience surrounded by a community that I was still just feeling like, do I deserve to be here? There was so do I deserve this? Can I claim this? If all of my previous relationships didn't look like this, all of that sort of like, it's right, but where do I belong in this space? And finally looking for belonging instead of fitting in, mm-hmm. which to me are two very different things. So stepping into that, and that's what I talked about. I talked about stepping into my identity. And then the pandemic happened. And I had a conversation with a friend whose kiddo had a sensory processing disorder. And the way she talked about her kiddo's navigation of the world, and that their kiddo really understood kids with autism and really connected really well with them, it opened up this idea that autism wasn't what I grew up with. My father was a special education teacher in university. I stage managed a production where all the performers had folks supporting them, but they all had developmental disabilities. I have a dear family friend who cracks me up, and I've done a lot of respite support for his parents. So I've spent a lot of time with this hilariously gorgeous human being who still, to this day, I'll get like a messenger message from him, and it's always about who has died. Like, oh, do you know this person? Like, do you know, what was the last?
Like celebrities?
Like celebrities or authors, children authors. Did you know this person? Do you remember them? And I know as soon as he's asked the question, they've just passed. And this is how he processes, and this is how he connects with me. Because I was with him when his grandmother passed. And his mom had to go back home to the Caribbean to be there and take care of those things. And I was the one staying with him at that point in time. So I am that person, and it is one of his special interests and right. happens and how that works, but I was with him, so this is still this connection, and like, to me, he has autism, that's just how he looks at the world, but he has high support needs, and it had not occurred to me that you could be autistic and have your support needs not register, like, they just don't register. I mean, my dad always said that his older brother was a professor of psychology who, like, lost tenure because he slept with all of the other faculty members' wives, like, in the 50s, maybe early 60s. My dad had always used that Nazi term about his brother. He always called his brother had Asperger's. He knew. Mm-hmm. He knew that his brother had it. So, like, I knew there was, but they were all boys. Folks who were assigned male at birth. Or folks who socialized, they were all boys. When this mom was talking about her kiddo and autism, something that just like, just that little, I don't know if you, for you, what that feeling is of like, oh, there's a connection here. And it's wild how those show up and where they sit in your body or where they like, how it is that you know the like, oh, wait a second, I have to pay attention to this. So I started doing research. I talked to another friend who was sort of on that cusp, was exploring, like, her kiddos and how they were navigating the world. And so I started looking into what does it mean to be autistic.
Can I tell you, I consider myself neurodivergent. I have anxiety, depression, etc. But it just occurred to me as you were sharing, like, all the labor that you have had to do, like, even to explore and expose yourself to other cultures, like, is it's not readily accessible in mainstream media, but also this piece, too, with neurodivergence, all the work you had to do to even find out, like, language, that this is a thing, and damn.
That's a lot of work. It's a lot of work, but oh my god, like, tickled that autistic part of my brain that was, like, special interest time? I get to find out about a thing? Like, really tickled that part of my brain. So I did all the research and, like, really specifically because my gender piece hadn't even come into the picture yet. Yeah. Did the research, looked into it. What does it mean? How does autism show up in somebody who doesn't present as autistic? And I mean, I was specifically looking at women at the time because that's the language that I had, and discovered that, oh, there's such a thing as high masking autism. And that is a very different thing.
Talk about labor, too. The work.
Yeah.
Energy it takes to manage that.
And so you do the tests. You do that. This couldn't be possibly be true, but oh man, you read this list of different expressions and...
Might be autistic if...
And like, oh, but I don't fit all of them, so I couldn't possibly be. So you find the tests, you do the tests, and pursued a diagnosis. I pursued a diagnosis slowly. I made my way through it, but I kind of knew I was beforehand, and I needed that paper. For me, it was really important to have that paper. So, validation. Maybe. Yeah, and also because my family didn't want to acknowledge that I was. But I remember being like 14 and going like, what's wrong with me? 12, like, what's wrong with me? Why watching other people going, how can this not bother you? How can you be okay with what's happening? Or how can you move through these situations that to me are so impossible? And growing up thinking that there was something wrong with me, that I couldn't do it, that I couldn't manage to make like friendships were like, I knew people with whom it was easy for me to make friends with. The fringe people that weren't going to get me the fitting in that I thought I wanted. So I fought these, like, I don't know, that it was so complex. And it really took me until like being in my Quebec, we have Cégep instead of grade 12 and getting into that space, that pre-university space of like, oh, I don't have to care. So that still was that whole process of, like, when you figure out that, oh my god, I've been this kind of way this whole time, and you look back through your whole life and like, oh, that's why this happened. That's why this part was so important. Oh, that's why this was a struggle. And there's a lot of grief involved. But it opened up so much possibility of now I can, just starting to, 6 years later, figure out how to advocate for myself, figure out how to go, like, it's okay that I have different support needs. It's okay that I need things in a way that was so different from the message that was given to me of what you're supposed to be. And because I was autistic, I believed it. And it's okay that my queerness was subtle to me. It's okay that I didn't know that. So I discovered this autism, this neurodivergence, and met two friends actually the day after the Hannah Gadsby final show of Nanette, which is before I discovered the autism. But either way, I met two people that day, and one of whom was like deeply entrenched in their non-binary identity and their ADHD identity. Like they, like, these were cornerstones of their identity piece. Hung out with them, and like, they were so certain. They were also a good, like, almost 20 years younger than me. And we really hit it off and spent a lot of time together. And in spending time with them, it kind of allowed me to sort of re-examine my relationship with gender. So I discovered the autism, and yeah, maybe 6 months later, I started, like, right after I met my wife. I went, oh, yeah, being a woman, being a girl never fit right. It never made sense to me. I remember being a teenager going, and I can't girl right. I cannot. Discovering that it was like, this analogy is new to me, but like, it was an itchy wool sweater that was just the wrong size and just pulled in the wrong places. You know, it's just too tight in the throat, and other people can handle it, but I could not. It was a sensory nightmare. And my body, I love my body. Well, I'm not okay with the hormones I experience because they're really rough, but I don't feel like I need a different hormonal, and maybe that'll be the next step that I discover, balance or reality. I don't need my body to change. I don't need my voice to change. That doesn't make my identity any less real or important or profound. So, but stepping into queerness was like challenging but easy. Stepping into my autism was like, oh my god, this is amazing. Love it.
Finally.
Non-binary. So good. This is fantastic. But the disruptor piece, I have fought that part of my identity. I have fought it tooth and nail and done everything I can to avoid.
So tell me, what's the other side of that spectrum? Like, walk us through a little bit of, you know, one of the things that comes to mind is like people pleasing and like, don't want to rock the boat. So like things that might be in conflict with one another. What was that experience like? As you're looking back, knowing now that disruptor is part of your identity.
Masking, a lot of it was like, I knew I had different, like, I was a different person with different people.
alien kind of.
Hey? Yeah, I knew that, like, different aspects of my personality or different ways of coping with people really shifted who I was. So there was a lot of that masking, a lot of the, like, learning and, like, learning what is happening, learning what is expected from this group of people. How am I supposed to speak? How am I supposed to be? There was also, like, so many hangovers. I don't know how many hours I spent after, and still happens to this day, of, like, to do with alcohol, right. The hangover of having been in a social situation, and what did I say? What was right? What was wrong? Was I right in feeling that person didn't want to talk to me anymore? The doubt, the not believing my own experience was really challenging. But also the, like, deeply analyzing each moment of what has happened. And a big part of that was the autism. And the disruptor and the autism are very, they're so, so close together. The disruption is an expression of my autism. Mm-hmm. It is the, like, the piece that, well, why do we do the things that you say you do? And so there's that internal process happening while I'm trying to deny it and trying to fit in. So constant cognitive dissonance and not believing my own experience, like such a deep disbelief of my own experience. And I also gained so many skills in that, doing that, and coping mechanisms, and they protected me so well, even though they don't serve me well anymore. And now I'm trying to figure out my relationship with them so that I can try and do things differently, or do things that are more in alignment with me. I think mm-hmm. that's, like, this whole identity discovery, the stepping into each of my identity pieces has all been about becoming more in line with, so that my actions align more with my beliefs, stepping into my authenticity, stepping into integrity, that has been, like, really, really important and life-changing.
Skills and obviously all this research that you did, like, all this new information. One of my takeaways from what you've shared so far is, like, language. You know, how important and powerful it is to be able to call something something. It has a name. You know, I think about, like, therapeutic relationships in the past and conversations where the support person empowered me with that. I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, if you give the monster a name, it takes away its power. Like, you know, but on the other side of that too, like, how empowering it can be. Like, this is a thing. This is something that resonates with me. I can claim this for myself. It, you know, creates that sense of belonging, or at least, like, a dipping a toe into what that might be like.
Language also helps you figure out what pieces don't work for you. Like, the autism piece was, like, it was such a relief. It was such a relief. And for my family, there was such resistance against it. Because for them, what they saw was the box. I've had other folks who are on my transness, my non-binary gender reality. I've had folks give me some real pushback around, like, oh no, you're not safe. And for them, that's really true. Like, for a lot of folks, safety is conformity. Yeah. I think that's what we're living right now. And that's a lot of what the problems are happening right now in this reality right now, in this time, in 2025, in this space where fascism is setting roots and testing its limits, that for so many folks, it's the conformity that they find safety in, that's why they find trans people so threatening, is because being trans is a disruption. Being queer is a disruption. It is a refusal to conform. It is an unapologetic refusal to conform. And that is very threatening when you've been told that conformity is your safety and it's never fit you. And that's how I see what is happening right now. That's what I see as having allowed it to happen. Is this, like, if your conformity crushes you so much that your identity becomes deeply fragile, anything that contradicts, or anybody who is outside and living and choosing in any way to be outside of conformity, it's painful, it's threatening. Like, I don't think these folks are bad people. I think they're scared, and they're only, so many of them are only being given one option. One
two,
one
two
safety,
max.
Like one image of success. Mm-hmm. One, like, prosperity is so limited. so limited, and it's a giant wound as a result of colonial capitalism. Like, that's what colonialism wants. Like, colonialism is all about
Christo-fascism.
What did the colonizers come here and do, if nothing else, to suppress difference?
So what does disruption look like up close? Kind of moving into the magnifying glass here, right? We want to look at it in detail. As you've been sharing, I think about all of the steps involved and processes and just the concept of evolution, you know, happening in real time as you're discovering more information. It's like questions are being answered that you carried your whole life. But I'm thinking about the folks who might discover this organically and find themselves in a position where, like, all of this resonates, and what do I do about it? Where do I start? Like, how might you describe that?
So disruption has two ways that is received. Well, I'm going to start with reception, I think, because that was really helpful for me to have a friend reflect back to me that I had disrupted her life in a really important way, and she was so grateful for my disruption. So deeply grateful, and what she expressed to me, which was so helpful, was that for the folks who are ready for me, for the folks who are open and have the scaffolding. I think that's a really important thing to acknowledge, that a lot of folks, until you have the scaffolding, there's things you just can't do.
I'm thinking about all the people out there raw dogging, quote unquote, reality in the world.
Well, and beating yourself up because you have a relationship with something, a behavior or a substance that everybody's telling you is wrong and no good, when really you're just trying to get your brain chemistry right because you don't have any other scaffolding.
Just trying. Anything, like, hoping it works.
It is a very, like, another mark of colonialism, right? You should be independent. You should be able to do it. You should, like, you should, you should, you should, you should.
Shame, guilt, shame.
And to me, should is a shame word. Right. It is absolutely a shame word. And one that I lived for a long time. I should be able to, and I never could. But, so I come into spaces without intending to. I come into spaces and I'm not sure if swearing's welcome or not, but I fuck shit up. I fuck shit up. I make people uncomfortable. And there's some folks who recognize that discomfort is a launch pad for growth because they have the scaffolding to be able to do it. And there are other folks for whom discomfort is intolerable. Mm. And so you must crush the source.
Or run as far away and quickly as possible.
Most people respond with some form of violence.
I was going to say aggression, yeah.
Some form of, like, verbal, social, like, I think ostracization. Some folks use that alienation, the exclusion, and that's violence. And because I had learned how to read people really well, I knew exactly what was happening. I knew exactly when that, like, oh, the conversation stopped because I approached and backs are just slightly shifting or not even shifting. I knew what that meant.
The air, like the temperature, the energy changes.
100%
They weren't ready for you.
So that peace for me is really, like, and that's also how I find my people. My disruption allows me to find the people who are my community and, like, the people with whom, like, oh shit, we get each other. Okay. And it is, I have not realized, and maybe until this moment, just how deeply it has served me in terms of finding my people, finding the folks who are family, and figuring out what family is and who family is. And my disruption has really caused that, because if you can't handle me, you cannot handle me. You can't, because I don't know what is not to be discussed. That makes no sense to me. Because in my mind, if we don't talk about it, we can't understand it, we can't navigate it, we can't accept it, we can't.
It just festers. And
it, like, the unspoken for me is like, oh no, 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 that makes no sense. Why wouldn't we? No, this thing happened and it hurt me, or I did this thing and I can see it hurt you. And if we can't talk about it, we can't resolve it. Shoving it in a, like, emotional hoarding. So, like, that hoarders, like, hoarders, and hoarding, I think, is a physical manifestation of emotional hoarding, right?
Yeah,
like,
definitely.
You take the thing, oh fuck, I don't know what to do with this, I am going to jam it into this room where I close the door, and then it piles out of the room, and it's, you're walking on layers, like, you're not even, you're 3 feet from the floor, or a foot from the floor, you're, like, you have pets that are, like, there's, who knows what waste is in this space, and it's because you haven't had a chance to look at it. Actually, this, here, Maggie, this is for you. So, for me, learning what my feelings are and learning how to feel them has been, like, creating and curating an emotional wardrobe and figuring out, what does this feeling feel like? How do I wear it? How do I embody it? How does it sit on my shoulders? Does it feel good? Doesn't it feel good? Or what other piece do I need to have with it so it does
make
feel
it work?
Good? What, like, how do I feel these four things at once? And then, okay, I've worked through it. I've been exploring somatic experiencing. So there's this real feeling of, like, sitting with the feeling. What is happening in my body? What is my body telling me? What does my body want? Take it out when I need it.
Mm-hmm.
And I will put, and now I have a relationship with this feeling. I know when I need to call on my anger. I know when I need to call on my sadness, my introspection, my curiosity, my joy, my compassion. Like, you know what? I need to pull on this tired because I need rest.
Mm-hmm.
I need to pull on this boredom because this conversation is not for me. I need to pull on my joy because I'm not connected to it. And what is happening? There are miracles happening. And as I get to know it better, I get to pull in the little piece because it's my relationship with it has changed. So now I'm doing, modifying this garment so that it fits. I'm modifying this relationship, personalizing. And like, am I embroidering on these new experiences into it and making this garment, this relationship with this emotion, richer and fuller and more beautiful? Because they're all beautiful. They're not all comfortable. They're not all easy. Each of these feelings that we have are so important. They are our tapestry. They are information. They are how we, at least how I will intellectualize with the best of them. Bitch, give me an opportunity to intellectualize something.
Same.
I am over it like Same. A dirty shirt. Like, oh, this is so good.
I can't wait to grok the concept.
God, this is amazing. And also, as I'm learning how to feel these feelings and get into my body, my relationship with these feelings is like just growing. And now I can, oh, it doesn't have to be yelling for me to feel it. It doesn't have to be screaming. I don't have to be screaming.
I feel so like
this is, it's resonating really deeply. I'm also still very hyperfixated and attached to this analogy and metaphor of the wardrobe. Like, fit issues, you know what I mean? Like, well, they all fit.
Is the fit because I'm not putting it on right?
Exactly.
Is the fit because I'm trying to stick the wrong arm, the wrong body part into the wrong...
An arm through a leg hole?
Or even my right arm through the left? Or my, you know, when you put on a shirt that's like different and like you've got your arm through the neck hole and like
or
you're
inside
just...
out.
Inside out or backwards, or it's got a tag that doesn't work. Or when I put it on, that's not quite right because it's missing a piece. Or I want it to be a different color. And it's not. It's this color.
It's what it is, right? There's room for all of it.
And do I need to dye it so that my perception of it becomes different? Do I need to spend some time with it? Do I need to? And all of those pieces, we all deserve the space to be able to feel those things. And it's like one of the... Like, I'm going to go back to colonial capitalism because
Please
for me,
do.
It is like on a very personal level, it is the biggest evil that has happened to every individual who has experienced it. And I don't know that there's many folks in this world who have not been the victims of colonial capitalism in some expression, form, version, because the settlers were just as messed up and imposing violence, the violence that they had, that had been imposed on them. And that is the story we need to change. That is why we need to listen to Indigenous voices, why we need to reconnect with ourselves so that we can reconnect with others, so that we can reconnect with the earth who supports us, even though we have been the biggest assholes to her.
Jeez.
Giant assholes.
Talk about abuse and neglect.
Spirituality, whatever that looks like for you, connect to the fact that we are all connected, that everything that we do, it's all enmeshed. We are interdependent. And it's so easy to use the word interdependent. Like, whenever I heard people talking about codependence, I was like, but we need each other. So why is codependence wrong? Like, it's interdependence, which is a very different reality. And it's so easy to conflate the two. It's so easy and tempting. But we are interdependent. My well-being to learn how to feel my feelings means that others in my community can be around me and feel some sense of safety or connection or rightness. And it's also what disrupts the folks who are not. Like, that's part of what that disruption is the folks for whom their hoarding situation smells real bad and they have to use all the big sense to cover it up. Like, what are they doing so that nobody knows that they live? How are they presenting? What are they doing to make themselves not appear to be as hurt, troubled, uncomfortable?
I'm like masking.
So what are the ways?
Literally and figuratively.
I would so go on a, like, deep tangent about, like, how much I hate fabric softener. Like, yeah. I hate it with every fiber of my being. It is a hormone disruptor. The smell, like, I should not be able to smell you doing laundry from, like, 3 blocks away. Like, right. Stop it. Mm-hmm. No. Why are we covering up scents? You are not feeling well. Your body smells different. That's important information. Mm-hmm. But they're covering up things when things don't stink. They're covering up, like, so things look pretty. And I think that's also part of gender.
Smoothing it over.
Like, I didn't understand why, to be a woman, I never figured out how to do my hair. Like, I get haircuts that are wash and go. I will spend no more than 2 minutes on this.
I'm looking at you right now. I'm telling you, you got it figured out.
It may have taken me almost 5 decades to do this, but, like, I know now what I need for this to work. And I found more than multiple hairdressers who are like, you mean the cut is gonna... it's a challenge. You build that relationship. It's a different way of connecting.
Totally.
But I never got why, like, I was supposed to, I couldn't figure out clothes. It's why we met. That's why, why Kate made sure that we had a relationship was because I could not figure out clothes. It didn't make sense to me because what was felt good for me is what every time I tried it on, it just looked wrong. What I was supposed to be interested in, what I was supposed to look like. I was supposed to wear makeup, which makeup is a lot of fun. Don't get me wrong, but it feels like a weird, like it's the metaphorical mask. For me.
It's not for everyone.
It's not for everyone. And, I mean, don't get me wrong. On the right day, I want that eye pop. I want that, like, little piece because I'm celebrating and it's another accessory that makes something special. But most of the time, I want my face naked. I don't even want nail polish. Like, I can feel my nails are not breathing well. They're, like...
Oh, same.
They're suffocating. Same. Like, no, I can't do it. So yeah, for me, there's that piece. It's all about coming back to authenticity. And if you can get into sitting okay with yourself, there's the space to breathe. There's the space to have that relationship with your own emotions, the relationship with your... And then you're open to start discovering, like, okay, what are the... How do I want these relationships to be with myself, with my feelings, with others? Oh, this piece that I'm doing doesn't feel like... Doesn't... I can now listen to that emotion enough to be able to go... Okay, we're close to that, but we've got another thing happening that isn't right. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's switch it. Let's tweak it. Let's change it. And then all of a sudden, you're curating your own experience, and your behavior lines up so much more with your beliefs and your values. And we all have moments where those coping mechanisms, those skills that we learned to protect us so valiantly, like that 6-year-old yelling and screaming and pushing somebody away, that was how they remained safe. That's how they remained safe with the people who were supplying them food, shelter, clothing, right? Like those pieces that feel so ugly and are so that we're, they're so steeped in shame because we are told it's not polite. You're not being polite. You're not fitting. You're not conforming. You're making me uncomfortable.
You're too different. Too much. Too big. So dramatic. Too sensitive.
That was a hard one. Hard one to take on for me. Yeah. But those were all such beautiful and valiant efforts for us to navigate trauma. For us to navigate and stay in relationship with the people who helped us, who offered us the basic needs of life, without whom our survival would not have been possible.
It's scary to leave them behind. I'm kind of in that space right now where I'm like,
absolutely. It has protected you.
And
for
you
how
might need
long?
Them again one day.
Maybe.
And that's what I'm learning right now in, like, learning what my feelings are. At the same time, I'm also like, step on my toe into something that I've never stepped my toe into, which is internal family systems. Because I had understood it as, I will let this go and, like, leave it behind. Or let it rest and sleep. No, what I can actually do is go, hey, okay, I see you. Your skill is pretty... You are very good at protecting me. That is very awesome. Can we do this side by side instead of you standing in front of me? You take the lead. But like, I want that protection. Absolutely. But you've taught me enough. Can you now watch me or just hold my shoulder while we do this? Can this deep, compassionate person who wants to caregive for everybody else, because that is the only way they're going to love me, is if I'm taking care of them? Okay. Can you turn and face me so that we're looking at each other and we can take care of me and give me a little bit of space to breathe?
We hear that phrase and that word a lot. I use it a lot in my work. It's anyone who knows about self-magnitude knows about the glasses and the metaphor around feeling and being seen. It is like there's the physical, like practical, like I see you. You're here, you're in front of me, I have vision, I can see you. But it's like, without shame, don't judge me, don't criticize, just like, radical acceptance. You know?
I see you. Like that, I trained as a doula, it's one of my, like, 48 different things that I And one of the things that was so, like, one of the biggest gifts I learned was to see folks who had just become parents, or added a new member to their family, or... like we're going through the transition of being a pregnant person into being a parent, being the partner of a pregnant person into being a parent, just seeing them. I see you. I see you working hard. I see you loving hard. I see you being and doing your best, even if I don't agree with it, even if it's ugly, even if it's messy and smelly and too loud. And you saw me and you helped me see me in a new way. And that's what that's what breaks my heart about what's happening right now, is that so many people just aren't being seen. And they feel that poverty. They don't know what it is because they aren't in touch with their feelings. They're hoarding all their stuff, like they're shoving it away. So they don't know what it is. So it must be somebody else's fault. It's the immigrant's fault. It's the trans people's fault. It's the queer people's fault. It's the protester's fault. It's the poor people's fault. It's the, like...
Yeah.
If somebody else can see me and look at me and see my messiness, which is so hard. Like, I'm not trying to say vulnerability is easy. It is the hardest. It is, Kate, my wife and I talk all the time about, like, a vulnerability hangover. Like, oh, I got seen. It's tough. It's very uncomfortable. But when we allow ourselves to be seen and allow ourselves to see other people, I mean, that's one of the purest forms of love. It's one of the most important and simple and complex and deep and powerful things we can do is to approach each other with love. And I don't
know. No conditions.
Unconditional. Well, it can be conditional. Oh, I can, like, I love you.
Boundaries are
important. I love who you are.
And?
I love that you are, or maybe I don't love who you are. I love and appreciate that you are a human being. You are a dog. You are a cat. You are a tree. You are a plant. You are a rock. You exist. You are worthy of love.
And
what your relationship with me... Well, we don't have to have one. And I can love me enough to not have that relationship with you. I can love me enough to put on my parka when I go out in the snow.
Go out in a damn bikini. I was just thinking, like, back to the wardrobe analogy. Like, you get to decide
how much you're covered up. Protection. And emotions can be that too, right?
My best friend, who happens to be napping upstairs in this very space, the meta level of all of this is not lost on me. They introduced me to this concept of, like, gearing up. Like, it's like you picture a SWAT team and there's all these different pieces, right? And depending on, I think about certain situations or certain people, and it's like, okay, do I need the bulletproof vest today? Do I need the shield? Do I need the baton? Do I need all of it?
Do I wear it all?
And take it off.
And then figure out, like, how much do you get to see me without this armor?
Yeah.
Like, who gets to see this? Who gets to see me in my bikini? Mm-hmm. Who gets to see? Because just because I'm here does not mean you are entitled to me.
That's fucking right. I know we haven't said the word patriarchy or male gaze, but I think there's something to be said there, certainly, in your journey with identity and relationship to gender and taking up space and all of those things. It's also scary when you realize you get to decide. It's like, oh shit, now I have decisions to make.
I'm in control.
Yeah.
That's actually terrifying. Yeah. Like, we use control as a way of avoiding feelings, right? We use control as a way of avoiding authentic connection.
You're killing me in this. Shots fired, y'all.
I'm disrupting. This is what I do, right? Like, this is a form of my disruption, too, is I disrupt by seeing people. I disrupt by putting ideas together that feel disparate. Like, it is uncomfortable. We're not used to being seen. We're not used to having somebody have compassion around things we feel shame for. Like, it is one of the biggest things that I learned in parallel with, like, stepping into my queerness. I was reading somebody who had some really interesting things and, like, changed my relationship or my perception of addiction. Because I was dating somebody at the time who was really struggling with addiction. And reading the view that addiction is simply a way, and I'm not talking, it can be substance, but it can also be behavior. It can be, there's,
it's, it manifests.
It's having an unhealthy relationship or having a relationship with something that is hurting you. So yeah. You can have what other people think is an addiction, but actually it's not hurting you. You've got actually a good relationship with that thing. Some people can gamble and have it be a very simple, straightforward, I go in, I do the thing, I have my budget, I live with it, and that's fine. Other people cannot. So you can have the different relationships with the same thing. But the view that addiction is really just more about, right? You are using the one tool that you had access to, or maybe multiple tools, and nobody else gave you any better tools, so we all use the tools that we can. Because mine is more socially acceptable, or, like, it doesn't make it more than anybody else's. Who the fuck am I to decide that somebody needs to have a drink to be able to navigate a social situation? And maybe they relied on it so much that relationship got weird. That is an unhealthy story. That is a shame story.
Absolutely. Totally tied to colonialism.
And how we survive it.
So, what do we do, right? What do we do now? What do you do? Maybe specifically, as we're moving into the megaphone segment, like, maybe who inspires you? Who do you look to for, not validation, you found that, right?
I'm constantly seeking, like, there's new pieces of me that as I'm able to change that relationship with myself and curate my relationship with my feelings and other things, like, stuff comes up, right? Like, the dirty socks, the stinky, that piece that you never washed, right? Because it's, I mean, I'm not trying to admit that my closet looks good, right? Like, it's there.
It exists.
It exists. Because I have not, like, changed my relationship with, like, But each of those steps, it's like finding that compassion and accepting that it's going to be messy. For me, that's been a big piece is figuring out that it's going to be messy. But also finding the paths that work for you. For me, somatic experiencing, working with a somatic experiencing practitioner whose focus is social justice as opposed to prescriptive. Yeah. Wow. The finding the tools that work for you. Because somatic experiencing through a social justice lens works for me. And it works for me because I've also tried. I've tried CBT. I've tried acupuncture. I've tried a Canadian version of osteopathy, which is not the US version, but that's like a whole other tangent that I know we are well past time. Massage, reflexology, diet, like figuring out my diet. I can't eat gluten or sugar. Like those are the things that, like, you find the pieces that work for you regardless of whether or not they work for anybody else. And I like to share the tools that I use so that somebody else can go, maybe I can try that on, see if that works for me. But it is so okay to walk away from a therapist. It is so okay to walk away from something that serves everybody else that does not serve you. So I think that's that action piece for me has always been find, like, find the places, figure out what your yes cue is. Like, allow yourself the grace to say no to something, even though everybody else around says this is amazing. You gotta try. And, maybe you do have to try it. Mm. Like, maybe you need to explore it, but that doesn't mean you have to keep it. Doesn't mean it's what you... So, like, if you can find one thing that makes you go yes, and that yes is going to be quiet. It's not always loud. Mm. Like, listen to that very quiet voice that goes, and that's possibly the deepest act of love that we can have for ourselves, is to start finding it like stupid simple ways. Do I want the popcorn or not? Like, we're not talking about like, is this the right job? Am I in the right career? Like, that's unfair. That's too big. But like, do I like this brand of toilet paper? Is it in alignment with my values? Do I need to prioritize comfort over like
price
or like, what is the piece, but what is the quiet yes about this thing? What is the quiet no, so that I can then pick the next right thing and I can practice like just little things. Do I like this? Do I like the pattern of this pillowcase? Do I like, and I want to acknowledge that what is little is different for everybody. Like, what is little, what is important.
Totally subjective, yeah.
And it's also not just subjective, it's also a real reflection of privilege.
Yes, yes. Thank you for saying that.
It is a deep, deep reflection of privilege. I have had so much privilege. I pass as a non-binary person. I passed enough as an autistic person. My support needs were fit in people's ideas of where somebody might need help. I had the privilege of when my body could no longer let me work, that I was able to stop working. Like, I have so much privilege, and I am not gonna take away anybody else's. What is easy for me or what is hard for me? Your easy, your hard are valid. Your sad, your joy, whatever that looks like, that is valid. Just because somebody has it harder than you or somebody has it easier for you does not erase your validity of your grief, your joy, your, like, it all gets to look different. And because it is yours, it is valuable. So because it is yours, then you get to listen to your yes. You get to listen to your no. You get to listen when your body says, we're not staying here. And it can start in like a small way when you're like, I don't like this commercial. I'm going to get up. Like, not that we really have commercials anymore, but like, change, I don't want to watch this commercial. I can change the channel. Or my body, I want to walk away. So I'm going to get up and I'm going to walk around and just allow myself to get up and take three steps away and then come back. Do it low stakes, really low stakes. Gonna feel dumb at so low stakes.
Need to pee.
Right? And in different moments, do I need to pee is different stakes. Like, totally. You're in the car. Like, are we stopping this car? Like, we've been in the car for only 30 minutes and it's gonna extend our trip by like, we've got 8 more hours to drive. And if we stop right now, like, those tiny things of, and is the yes, maybe, do I have to pee? Do I need? And you do it in those low stakes ways. So sometimes, yeah, going pee is, can I leave? Am I allowed? Does my job allow me to have a pee break? Does this public transportation, where's the next available washroom that I can use that I can walk into that feels safe?
Right.
Right? So, yeah. So start with the pee at home. Like, do I have to pee? Start with it in a space, whether it's at home or whatever feels like home for you, where you have access to the resources you need to be able to take care of the need that is important right now. Start easy. With whatever is easy for you, and start in its easiest place.
Thank you so much for this. There are two things. Obviously, we want to get to the megaphone. I know there's
I feel like this was kind of megaphone-y. Well,
it definitely very megaphone-y, but there is a specific organization that you wanted to shout out. But also, again, I'm still like old news, like an hour ago in our conversation, you said you thought you wanted to be a mom. So that language perhaps doesn't fit.
It does. My kiddo through marriage.
I ask you, do you have a child? Do you have a parent? I mean, are you a parent?
Yeah, I am. Though I tried to get pregnant on my own for like 2 really painful years. Really, really painful years. And trying to get pregnant, fertility journeys are no joke. They're no joke. Even figuring out whether or not you, like, do you want to be a parent? Like, you get to decide that at any point in time, that it's a yes or a no.
And did you get it? Did you find it?
I got it. It has nothing how I expected it.
Like, yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Autistic parenting was a special interest. pregnancy was a special interest.
Totally.
And everything I learned, none of it applied. Like, none of it. It was, nope, that did not. Nope. Okay, this thing that I thought I knew, that I was like, hey, I've looked at this. I've supported other people figuring this out. Like, I got this. Nope. None of it was useful. I had to throw it all out. So yeah, stepping into that parent identity is, I knew it was filled with doubt and like, am I doing it right? Am I messing everything up? I knew that. Now I know it. It's gone from a head knowledge to a body knowledge. So valuable and like deeply important and also so uncomfortable.
So where do we find hope? For you personally, is there someone, someone's, something, again, like, I think I might have asked it as, you know, like, what do you look to for inspiration? Who do you look to for inspiration? But I think it's more like what gives you hope?
Every moment of resistance, every act of resistance gives me hope. Every decision I see anybody make to not conform, to like listen to themselves instead of what should be. When you choose the, it's not always the harder path, but when you choose the path that is in alignment. But yeah, choosing, seeing folks who inspires me, because I'm still fighting the desire to fit in. Rejection is still the most painful, like one of the most triggeringly painful things. It's not maybe the most painful thing, but oh, that rejection triggers me in a very, gets my rejection sensitivity dysphoria. Like, it's tough. It's really tough. And also being able to see somebody who can like be brave about shit that I find hard. Like, oh man, that's so wild. Got a friend who I spoke to this weekend who, like, I admire this person who is almost two decades younger than me, who, like, discovered early on that when she got on public transport, she was gonna man spread. She was just gonna take up as much space as possible, and, like, and if a guy came towards, like, trying to get into her space, she just pushes against. Like, she's like, no, no, you're not gonna make me uncomfortable in this space. You deserve to be uncomfortable in this space. You have been comfortable too long. And that's like, yeah, that's what gives me hope. And I guess the organization that for me kind of embodies a whole bunch of this, I hadn't realized how much they embody this, is one called, I'm going to say the name in French because I think bilingualism is really rad. And it's something that is one of those things that people find really challenging here in the U.S., which was very astounding for me. Not just Canada, Quebec. It's deeply. So it's La Coalition des Familles LGBT+, or the LGBT+ Family Coalition in Quebec, which is an organization that supports queer families through fertility journeys, through being different, and like, what, how do you figure out, how do you make a parent, not birthing parent, a legal parent? They support Indigenous queer folks and their queer families. They support BIPOC families or families of the global majority who are queer. They, in a province that is remarkably progressive and incredibly backwards in different ways. Quebec, I don't know if you know this. Here's a little tidbit for everybody
fun,
out there.
Fun fact.
Quebec is the place in North America where abortion is the most accessible. In every kind of, I guess it's an equivalent to a county, they made a law, in the 60s or the 70s, you had to be able to access the same services in every region. So you can get an abortion in every region of Quebec. And it's not even a question. Finding out that people were bringing over abortions, offering abortion, was, like, astounding to me. Because I grew up with it being just, of course it's a choice. Well, my choices don't hurt anybody else.
That's right.
They might make you them
unless they do, in which case.
Well, my choice is my behavior.
Right. Right.
My behavior.
Behavior is a choice as well. This has been such an amazing conversation. I am sure to be processing it for some time. I use the phrase shots fired a couple of times, like, I feel very seen in this moment, and it is an interesting experience that I didn't quite anticipate in the context of this whole journey and all of the connections and conversations that are happening. Like, you know, seeing people is such a big part of my work, and it's like, holy shit, you just held up a mirror, and I feel seen, and it is pretty wild. I'm really grateful, and I cannot wait for listeners to hear this episode. Thank you, Erica.
You're so welcome. And you thought you were coming here just to hang out with our fur babies, and all of a sudden,
heck?
You're in a basement having these wild conversations.
It teaches me to have expectations. Like, write that down, y'all. Just be open to the feelings, the any other maybe like specific calls to action for folks who are listening. Like, I keep coming back to this phrase, like, okay, we know these things now. Like, what do we do?
To my trans siblings, keep yourselves safe. We don't need to be on the front line. We need to keep ourselves safe. And to my queer family and my, if you are safer than somebody else, stand in front of them. Ask their consent first, but stand in front of them, because we are going to have to put a lot on the line to fight what's happening right now. And there's so much complacency. We can no longer be complacent. And hopefully when this airs, this is history. Like, I am hopeful that this is history, that there's going to be, but there's too much complacency right now for me to believe that that's going to be. I am optimistic that we might be in a different place, but there's too much complacency right now. And I think folks have to get really accustomed to the idea that we're all in danger. White folks have to get, like, listen to Black folks. They have known all along. Yeah. Listen to Indigenous folks. Listen to folks with less privilege than you. Believe them. And learn how to sit with your discomfort, because this is just going to get way more uncomfortable. And if you're not thinking about this right now, it's going to hit you like a ton of bricks when it does.
That's all for this episode of Attention Confidential, but of course the conversation doesn't end here. I encourage you to keep exploring, keep questioning, and most of all, keep sharing your stories. If today's conversation spoke to you, please pass it on. And if you have a story of your own you'd like to showcase, I am here and ready to listen. You can find all past and future episodes at selfmagnitude.com/podcast. And until next time, remember this. Your voice matters. Attention Confidential is sponsored, produced, and distributed by Self Magnitude LLC, an ethical microbusiness on a mission to transform how you see yourself. It is hosted by Maggie Green, personal brand and style strategist for weirdos and queerdos of all ages and gender expressions, who is also the face and voice behind Self Magnitude, helping people feel seen since 2020. If you're looking for support on embodying all aspects of your identity and showing up as your radically authentic self in person, in print, and online, please visit Maggie's 100% DIY website at selfmagnitude.com.